this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The COVID-19 pandemic's impact on American families' economic situation was recognized early on by governments at multiple levels who instituted a variety of relief measures, particularly related to rent and evictions. But as this pandemic has dragged on, some property owners have grown increasingly concerned about not being paid by their tenants, with some landlords even taking legal action. A group of Northern Kentucky property owners and the Greater Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky Apartment Association sued over an eviction moratorium issued by Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear. That prompted the governor to revise his order to be more in line with federal guidelines and to offer a relief opportunity for both tenants and landlords. Often, when discussing lower-income families and the prospect of eviction, the focus is on inner-city residences, but recently conducted research indicates that evictions can happen at an alarming rate outside the city limits. Take, for instance, Silverton, a first suburb just outside the city of Cincinnati, where recent data analysis concluded that a majority of evictions over the past 4 years before the pandemic-induced eviction crisis are often over just a small amount of money. Joining Cincinnati Edition to talk about the eviction crisis in the suburbs is University of Cincinnati Political Science Department Associate Professor and Masters of Public Administration Director, Brandy Blessed. Dr. Blessed, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Silverton Village Manager Tom Carroll, who conducted this research. Tom, welcome back to our show.
Thank you, Michael. Great to be here.
And a research assistant, Deirdre Carroll. Deirdre, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, I'm looking forward to talking to you as well. Deirdre, I understand you're a 17-year-old student who helped your father, Tom, conduct this research. So we'll talk a little bit about that. Tom, you're a village manager here locally, but this isn't the first time you've appeared on the program to talk about some very significant research that you've conducted. And this latest report that you and your daughter gathered, The Contours of Evictions in a Midwestern First Suburb, looks at your own village as well as a lot of the other first suburbs in Hamilton County. For the sake of our listeners, and maybe as a reminder to me even, tell us what a first suburb is.
Right. So a first suburb is a standalone municipality, a city or a village. We would also count townships as first suburbs outside of the city of Cincinnati. Across the country, there are hundreds of first suburbs around metropolitan areas, whether it's Chicago, Boston, New York. First suburbs were generally established right after World War II. So when the GIs came home from World War II, with the GI Bill, they were able to buy single-family homes. Think of Levittown as an example. So first suburbs had their boom years in the 15 years after World War II, and then they were eventually ringed in by the interstate highway system, and then other suburbs grew up outside. So first suburbs are kind of sandwiched in between the central city, in our case, Cincinnati, and outer ring suburbs like Westchester and Mason.
And in this report, you've included some very informative tables comparing the rates of evictions in a lot of these communities, and also an analysis of the changes in poverty rates among certain Hamilton County first suburbs. And I just want to give people an idea of what poverty might look like just in terms of numbers in some of these other places outside of the city of Cincinnati. For example, the research by the Carrolls found that the 1999 poverty rate in Fairfax was 5.1%. And 18 years later, in 2017, that had risen to 8.9%. Deer Park saw an increase from 5.3 to 8.1. Arlington Heights saw 5.4 to 15.9. And Cheviot saw 7.6 in 1999. To 2017's rate of 20.7. Tom, what's happening in these first suburbs where we're seeing this increase in a poverty rate?
It's a great question. So for the first time in the United States, there are more people below the poverty line living in America's suburbs than there are in the central city or rural America. And this was a finding from the Brookings Institution in 2013. And so in the last 20 years nationally, there has been this huge increase in people who are experiencing poverty in communities where they didn't used to live. And that comes from a variety of factors, one of which is there's a lot of people who were in the middle class or working class and have simply fallen out and they're now below the poverty line. Those are people who were able to live there and were part of the community 20 years ago, and they're still part of the community, but now they're just in a lot worse economic situation. as well as there's an outmigration of people below the poverty line from the central cities in the United States to the adjacent suburbs. So where do they go? They go to the next nearest community where they can afford a house. And oftentimes those are first suburbs like Silverton or North College Hill or Mount Healthy, also places like Cheviot and Arlington Heights. So what you've seen in the last 20 years, both nationally and in our region, is a real split. You had the communities you mentioned were all very similar in 1999, but now Cheviot and Arlington Heights have a significantly higher percentage of their population that's below the poverty line. So there's a real bifurcation in our region and across the country.
Okay, so we see some economic disparity growing in those first suburbs, Tom. And I also note in your research that in Silverton specifically, you found that just over 72%, actually almost 73% of the landlords who filed evictions in your village were a corporation. Why does that matter?
Well, a lot of people who might own, if I were a landlord and I just own one or two houses or apartments, I probably will form a corporation to conduct the business of being a landlord to protect my personal assets. But what we found in Silverton is that there are a dozen corporations that are responsible for over half of the evictions in the community. And this was what Deirdre was able to do, going through each and every one of the eviction filings and figuring out who are the parties and who do they represent. So these corporations, there are a number of them. And I don't want to paint landlords all with one brush. There are lots of very good landlords. But there are a few companies that are just really problematic, both for the village's perspective and from an eviction standpoint.
And I want to know, you say that there are 12 corporations that represented more than half. The exact number is 51.69% of the eviction filings in Silverton. But you go on to note that four of those entities filed nearly 30%, just over 29% of all of the evictions. Let's bring in Dr. Brandy Blessed, an associate professor in the University of Cincinnati's Political Science Department. Dr. Blessed, what is the impact that this number of evictions and the period that was analyzed by the Carrolls was 2014 to 2017, but we're also seeing a potential eviction crisis on the horizon as it relates to people's economic uncertainty due to the pandemic. What is the impact to communities when you see numbers like this?
I think it's astounding, honestly. And I think part of that is because much of our conversation has been enlightened due to the COVID pandemic, right? But the reality is that these have been longstanding issues in communities, not only inner city, but as Tom has noted, in first ring suburbs and other communities. And I think part of that is an acknowledgement that there are systemic level issues that we need to begin to think about. The employment or wages have been stagnant for years now, right? People are unable to afford housing. When you think about the fact that wages have been stagnant and or decreased, and the fact that housing costs continue to rise, there's a disproportionate effect, particularly on communities, but also for communities of color. And so I think that we need to be mindful about not focusing in on this moment, but looking at the trajectory of policies at the state and local level, but also to what extent has federal intervention or lack thereof contributed to this windfall of unfortunate experiences for local residents.
And Dr. Blessed, you're an associate professor in the Political Science Department at the University of Cincinnati, but also the director of the master's program in public administration. And I understand that a lot of folks who achieve that degree will go on to lead municipalities like Tom. And what kind of situation do you see students that you are dealing with when they finish that program and they find themselves working outside of a large city, maybe just outside of a large city, and leading one of these smaller villages or townships or small cities? What type of situation are they going to find as it relates to their housing stock, since housing prices within the city core have risen so dramatically?
Well, I mean, I think that they're going to have to understand the collaborative or cooperative arrangements that currently don't exist, but that they need to begin to think about as it relates to partnership with their local municipalities. So our program at the University of Cincinnati has a social justice focus, and part of that is to be mindful of the ways for which policies and inequities are facilitated through decision-making by government officials, by public institutions. And so my thought is that when our students graduate, they're going to be able to understand how inaction in certain areas will continue to reproduce disparity for particular communities. And so the hope is that they're able to understand the need and the need around ways to engage, how to develop policy to be responsive, how to be cooperative and collaborative with their respective and adjacent communities. The reality is so often communities have been pitted against each other to be independent actors, and we did not get into this situation independently. It really is going to take a collective, really comprehensive and innovative opportunity and effort to get us out of this. Silverton alone cannot tackle this eviction, because whatever happens in Silverton is going to spill over into the proximate community. And so this has to be an issue that is of concern for all local municipalities, not only in Hamilton County, but across the country.
And we're also joined by Silverton Village Manager Tom Carroll and Research Assistant Deirdre Carroll. And Deirdre, we're going to get to you in just a moment. But first, Tom, one thing that really stood out to me when I was reading the research that you and Deirdre conducted here on evictions in first suburbs in Hamilton County was that, let me quote it directly just so I'm correct, the number of landlords filing an eviction for less than $500 of back rent, that was 31 over that period, is almost equal to the number of landlords that are owed more than 3,000. So when you look at a number like 3,000, you can maybe understand how a landlord might lose their patience. But for less than $500 to have just a couple more cases than the larger number was really surprising. What are these situations? I mean, did you look at the specifics of those cases, or what led to that?
Yeah, we did. And it may not be entirely clear from the filings that Deirdre went through. But what's really going on there, I suspect, is that there will be cases where a landlord isn't really upset about the amount of rent that is owed. They really just want the tenant to leave. And so they use a late rent payment as the tool to get the person out. And remember, I mean, I understand landlords have a right to get possession of their property back, but we're asking the tenant to actually leave his or her home and might have to relocate their children from one school to another. So for relatively small amounts of money, and amounts of money which for the tenant is probably insurmountable. I mean, these are people who are renting $500, $550 a month apartments. They obviously don't have a whole lot of money. So $500 to them or less is a tremendous amount of a burden that they can't claw their way out of. But it really starts this disruptive downward cycle in their life when they're forced out of their apartment and their kids relocate and they lose possessions. They have a higher rate of homelessness. There's a whole host of downstream problems that start over a relatively simple and small amount of money that they're owed.
An eviction on your record is very challenging to overcome when looking for a new apartment, is it not, Tom?
It is.
Yeah, well, and I would just add
and
to that.
And this is Deirdre Carroll, the research assistant here, and I'm glad you're chiming in. Deirdre, I was coming to you next, but please go ahead.
So the filings show that if a tenant has a writ of restitution on their record, that goes with them when they are in search of their next home. So if a writ of restitution occurs in the court proceedings, then that is kind of the thing that future landlords may look for when screening tenants to determine whether they want to lease the apartment or property to them. So the writ of restitution can be really problematic in the future for tenants in finding another home after they have been evicted.
Deirdre, this report that you produced with Silverton Village Manager Tom Carroll is very informative. Can you talk a little bit about the methodology and the different types of files that you had to go through in the analysis that you had to conduct?
Yeah, so we were looking at the database for the clerk of courts. So each eviction was filed and there was a complaint stating the amount of rent that was owed and the reason, which was almost always non-payment of rent. There wasn't really another reason for most of these cases. And then there would usually be a summons to the court that you would look through, and they would have a document stating whether the writ of restitution happened. And then there were other outcomes for the court, such as if there was just a judgment for the defendant, if the defendant did win, but that was in very few of the cases. Typically, it was a writ of restitution, or the case just kind of petered out and didn't really go anywhere if the landlord chose not to pursue more.
And Deirdre, I don't want to be too personal with you, but you are quite young when you think of someone who might be engaging in this type of research. What drew this to you? I know that maybe your father's line of work is of interest, but what brought you into it?
Well, it's funny because this summer I found myself in search of a job, and due to the state of the world and everything, I felt like I was much more comfortable working from home. And so I had the opportunity to help my dad with this research that he was starting. And it was really just the perfect storm, because I'm in my senior year of high school, and I know that I want to go into political science or economics. So these are questions that have really interested me, hearing what my dad has done with his work. So I was really excited to get a more hands-on experience looking at kind of the questions that I want to answer in the future.
Well, I hope he paid you well for the work that you did on this. And Tom, let me ask you, just as we start to wind down, what do you hope comes of this report?
So first, I paid her extremely well. Let's get that clarified. Second, I think this is some of the ways in which Brandy and the University of Cincinnati are kind of inspiring me and challenging me. I think we in public administration need to start to think differently and look at the root causes of some of these problems. And so in my research for ICMA, which was the research fellowship that we talked about earlier, started looking and realizing that the increase in poverty in these first suburbs is really the key fault line driving and separating communities that are thriving and those that aren't. And so then if you're looking at poverty, then you start looking at what causes poverty. And of course, people have been studying this for generations, but more recently, the wisdom has come out that evictions are a cause of poverty. They're not just a result of poverty, but they actually drive it and make people get into a downward spiral that's really very difficult to pull out of. So the University of Cincinnati and Brandy challenging public administrators like me to look at things like evictions is really, I think, something that I hope comes out of this. I hope more colleagues, more cities will look at this. It's not just a city of Cincinnati problem. It's not just an inner city Chicago, Detroit problem. It is happening in our communities and was happening well before the pandemic. And this is really going to separate those communities that over the next 20 years thrive and those that continue the downward spiral that many of them are in. I think we have an opportunity through public administration to look at root causes and see what we can do. And this, as Brandy said, the pandemic has shined a light on pre-existing fault lines. And we hope that people have a better understanding of it from this research.
And Dr. Blessed, I've got about 15 seconds. Is there anything that we need to learn about life in the suburbs? We're hearing a lot about the suburbs in the presidential election, but it sounds like it's not the rosy image that we might have.
I guess more than anything, I would just say that all communities need assistance. And so we need to be mindful about that and be willing to engage in policy decisions that are equitable, right, across jurisdictional lines.
Dr. Brandy Blessed from the University of Cincinnati. Sounds like you've got a good student in Silverton Village Manager Tom Carroll, maybe a good future student in Research Assistant Deirdre Carroll. Thanks to all of you for being with us to talk about this fascinating research. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder, technical director Josh Elstro. I'm Michael Monks.